Welcome to Washington Today for Friday, January 21st, 2022. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Here are some of today's headlines. Russian President Vladimir Putin could take less dramatic action in Ukraine that would vastly complicate a U.S. and allied response. The Associated Press reporting that Putin might carry out what President Joe Biden called a minor incursion, such as a cyber attack. That would leave the U.S. and Europe divided on the type and severity of economic sanctions to impose on Moscow and ways to increase support for Kyiv. We'll hear more from Paul Soni at The Washington Post. President Biden commended Intel's $20 billion investment to build chip factories for the U.S. economy to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. In remarks earlier, President Biden said COVID-19 has compounded problems with chips, so products like cars and dishwashers are delayed and demand is high. Intel's megasite will be constructed outside of Columbus, Ohio, on 1,000 acres of land in Licking County, and construction is expected to start near the end of 2022 and be completed in 2025. Momentum is growing for making changes to an archaic election law after former President Trump and his allies tried to overturn the Electoral College results. Multiple groups on Capitol Hill are working on reforms to the Electoral Count Act, which lays out how the Electoral College results are counted. And in a rare area of overlap, GOP leaders in both chambers and President Biden are opening the door to changes to the 1887 law. The Hill reporting that this comes after Democratic attempts to pass a sweeping voting rights bill unraveled. A Texas man who allegedly made election-related threats targeting government officials was arrested Friday in the first criminal case brought by a Department of Justice unit established last summer to bolster election security. Texas resident Chad Stark was charged with one count of communicating interstate threats, which carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. We begin in Geneva, Switzerland, where U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his Kremlin counterpart, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, have had no breakthroughs but agree to continue talks over U.S.-Russia tensions regarding Ukraine. Here's Secretary Blinken in a press conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
I do want to take this opportunity to share directly with you the common view of allies and partners, as well as concrete ideas to address some of the concerns that you've raised, as well as the deep concerns that many of us have about Russia's actions. I'll also make clear the fundamental principles that we are committed to defend. I also want to say, Sergei, that we need to talk about two U.S. citizens, Paul Whelan and Trevor Reed, who were tourists in Russia, were arrested, convicted without credible evidence, and we again ask Russia to do the right thing and let them come home. But the bottom line is this. This is a critical moment. You're right. We don't expect to resolve our differences here today, but I do hope and expect that we can test whether the path of diplomacy, of dialogue, remains open. We're committed to walking that path and to resolving our differences peacefully, and I hope we can test that proposition today and see where we go from here. Thanks for being here.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Geneva, Switzerland. President Joe Biden has warned that Russia could launch a military incursion into Ukraine within a month. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki reports on what the administration is doing to protect Americans abroad.
Does the president have a plan to evacuate Americans from Ukraine?
I know there have been a range of reports out this morning, which is probably why you're asking, Jackie. I will say that, one, we are already at a level 4 travel advisory for Ukraine for COVID and have advised that U.S. citizens have been advising that U.S. citizens should be aware of reports that Russia is planning for significant military action against Ukraine. We do conduct rigorous contingency planning, as we always do in the event of any security situation deteriorates in any country around the world. The State Department does that assessment. I would point you to them for any predictions or previews of any steps they may take.
Is there any effort right now to get a handle on how many Americans are in Ukraine? Because I remember with Afghanistan, that was sort of an open question. Is the dynamic different this time?
It's an open question around the world. We don't put a chip in Americans when they go to countries around the world and track their movements. People can register with the State Department. That's something they do. Or they may choose not to register. Or there might be people in any country around the world who are dual citizens who haven't lived in or have never lived in the United States. But the State Department would certainly have the number in terms of Americans who have registered with the State Department.
From the James Brady Briefing Room, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki taking questions from reporters. Paul Soni is National Security Reporter for The Washington Post. He's on the phone with us to discuss the latest on the U.S. tensions with Russia over Ukraine. The Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that avoiding Russia's possible invasion of Ukraine can be solved diplomatically. Paul Soni, from your research and reporting, does this seem likely at this point?
Well, so far, the Russians have made their core demands, which is that Ukraine and any other former Soviet republics not be allowed to enter NATO, and have even demanded that NATO's infrastructure and forces essentially be rolled back to their 1997 boundaries. The White House has said up front that this is a non-starter, that they're willing to negotiate on things like where missiles are placed in Europe, how the scope of exercises that take place, but they're not going to negotiate on NATO's open door policy or the sort of activities of the alliance within its current borders. That seems to be a sticking point. The Russians have come back and said, you're not listening to our core demands, you're not budging on our core demands, and essentially the other issues you're suggesting we negotiate on are secondary to what we're trying to achieve here. So it's really not clear if there is a diplomatic path out of this crisis.
In your article, you write about President Biden's Wednesday news conference that brought on a messaging issue for the Biden administration. But you write, quote, still by day's end, the administration appeared to have largely calmed the diplomatic waters. Well, Russian experts say President Biden was only saying what's happening behind closed doors. What are you hearing?
So there were kind of two things that happened in his press conference. He said that a minor incursion might not trigger the same kind of severe actions that the U.S. and Europe have threatened, because there would be disagreement within the alliance about how to respond, as opposed to an overt full-scale invasion. I think what he meant to say, what the White House has, he said he meant to say, what the White House has said he meant to say, is that action short of war, not a minor incursion, action short of war, like cyber warfare, like propping up proxy forces, assassination, sabotage, something that Russia could do in Ukraine without rolling tanks over the border, that would create a divide within the NATO alliance about how to respond. And so I think the minor incursion piece of his commentary was actually a gaffe. I don't think he meant to say minor incursion. I think he meant to say action short of war or gray zone tactics or whatever, however you want to phrase it. But the other part of his commentary, where he's saying that, the NATO alliance might be divided about how to respond to something when it's not an overt invasion, I think that actually is true. And it's something that the administration has tried to keep out of its talking points, because for the last couple of weeks, their main goal has been to show that the NATO alliance is united against the Russian threat. Everyone has agreed on how they're going to respond if Russia escalates towards Ukraine. And obviously, if you're a military alliance, you don't want to be signaling that there are any divides among your members that could be exploited by your adversary. So I think part of his commentary was just a straight gaffe, but also part of his commentary was sort of a bit of a Freudian slip in saying what the actual dynamic was between some NATO allies who really want to be very aggressive towards Russia, and some that are more reticent to do that.
And to that point, on CNN earlier, I heard a national security expert say that Russia has the upper hand in this situation for four reasons. Number one, not all of the Western nations are on the same page. The United States is divided politically. France is still bitter over the U.S., U.K., and Australia Joint Security Initiative, also known as AUKUS, and Germany seems to be reluctant over spending the resources on a war. And Putin knows that he can endure whatever sanctions comes to Russia, because in the next midterm U.S. elections, the former President Trump loyalists will return to power and Putin will essentially have their support. Now, does any of this track with your research?
I don't agree with most of that. I would say certainly it is the case that Putin is in the driver's seat here, because he created the crisis and he has the power to end it, right? So that kind of just is the state of play. And the administration has essentially said it is in his hands. He can decide to move forward with this or not. I also agree that there are divides between the United States and its allies, but I don't think they're exactly along the lines of what that analyst was saying. I think Germany's primary concern is not the cost of the war, but the cost to its own economy. Germany has a big dependent energy relationship with Russia. Most of its a huge portion of its energy comes from Russia, and German industry, which is really in many ways the heart of the European economy, is deeply dependent on that supply continuing to flow. And so obviously Germany is concerned about punishing Russia in a way that will have a severe blowback on its own economy. Those are concerns that are shared by other European nations, such as Italy, that have trade with Russia, or, you know, countries that are just a little bit further away from Ukraine and don't see that conflict as sort of real and in their backyard. As to the point about President Trump's allies, so I actually think the United States, you know, we have a lot of partisanship and rancor in our political system at the moment. But one of the things that the Democrats and the Republicans actually are pretty on the same page with is support for Ukraine. I think the Republicans would like the Biden administration to be even more forceful in its support for Ukraine, sending more aggressive military weaponry and leaning forward even more in response to the threat from Russia. But generally speaking, across the board, there is really a lot of uniform thinking about how Washington should back and support Ukraine in the face of threats from Russia. President Trump was an outlier on this issue. He certainly was more sympathetic to Russia and actually made statements that really kind of undermined Ukrainian sovereignty. He said things like, you know, Crimea is Russia because everyone speaks Russian there, even though Russia annexed that territory in 2014, and basically everyone in the West condemned it. And he sort of said things like Ukraine is not a real country, which really feeds into a lot of Russian narratives about Ukraine. So certainly President Trump was an outlier, but really everyone else in the Republican Party, maybe with the exception of Rand Paul, is really very supportive of Ukraine and doesn't share those views. So I don't really see that scenario necessarily playing out unless the 2022 midterms are some wholesale replacement of the Republican legislature with a Trump people. I think certainly probably more Trump-backed people, more people sharing Trump's views will come into power, but I don't see that kind of wholesale replacement being on the cards.
Paul Soni is national security reporter for The Washington Post. Find his reporting at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you for helping us understand this issue.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
The U.S. Conference of Mayors concludes its 90th annual winter meeting here in Washington, D.C. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke about threats to U.S. cities.
To be competitive for the future, look, I think our two greatest threats in this world is the amount of debt that we have federally and China. They're innovating faster than we are. They're taking critical minerals and others. And I would never bet against this country when we're all focused in the same path. And I think a lot falls on your shoulders as well. I think you're natural leaders throughout. I think you have the ability to set tones. There's so many times something devastating happens in your city that you have no control over. But the way you handle it, the way you are the father, the mother to the city itself, you heal, you become healthier, but also what you do as America, we watch it and we're there with you. I mean, there's not a moment in time that we don't see one of those stories that we're not crying at the same time and we're not feeling. May it be a natural disaster or something else. And after that takes place, you find the greatness of the nation that people come from all over just to provide food or shelter or others. I mean, when we start honoring those things and building those up better, I think people will look much more willing to do more of that.
House Minority Leader, California Republican Kevin McCarthy. Other threats to U.S. cities, guns. That's what U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke about at the U.S. Conference of Mayors annual winter meeting. Here's Attorney General Merrick Garland.
Just over 2 weeks ago, We announced a new rule to enhance safe storage of firearms that builds on our efforts to reduce the risk of firearms falling into the wrong hands. And as part of the President's FY22 budget request, we are seeking $1.6 billion in funding for ATF. Included are funds that would expand ATF's crime gun intelligence centers to the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network that city police departments use every day to trace crime guns. Also included are funds that would double ATF's capacity to investigate thefts from federal firearms licensees. You all know, as well as I do, that every firearm stolen from a licensed dealer poses a threat to community safety and to our law enforcement partners. The Justice Department's anti-violent crime strategy and our initiatives to stem the rising tide of illegal guns will help save lives. But we know full well that to succeed, all of us at the Justice Department and in mayors' offices and police departments across the country must work together. Finally, yet another important part of keeping the American people safe is protecting those who serve the public from violence and unlawful threats of violence. We have all seen that Americans who serve and interact with the public at every level, many of whom make our democracy work every day, have been targeted with violence and threats of violence. These are our fellow citizens who administer our elections, ensure our safe travel, teach our children, report the news, represent their constituencies, and keep our communities safe.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking at the U.S. Conference of Mayors annual winter meeting here in Washington, D.C. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines we're following. A federal judge in Texas, who was appointed by former President Trump, has blocked President Biden's mandate for federal workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19. The order comes after the Supreme Court earlier this month blocked President Biden's mandate that employees at businesses with 100 or more workers get vaccinated or regularly tested. The Supreme Court still upheld the vaccination mandate for healthcare workers. The Department of Justice immediately said it would appeal. Omicron surge is undermining care for other health problems. The Associated Press reporting that this winter's Omicron surge has not only swamped U.S. hospitals with record numbers of patients with COVID-19, it has also caused frightening moments and major headaches for people trying to get treatments for other ailments. Less urgent procedures have been put on hold around the country, such as cochlear implant surgeries and steroid injections for rheumatoid arthritis. And people with all sorts of medical complaints have had to wait in emergency rooms for hours longer than usual. Speaking of COVID, at the White House COVID-19 response team briefing, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, said the latest data continues to show vaccine boosters provide the best protection against the Omicron variant. And responding to questions from reporters, White House COVID-19 response coordinator Jeff Zients said some of the free at-home COVID-19 tests that millions of Americans have ordered online via a government website started shipping on January 20th. Here's Jeff Zients.
I know that COVID tests have begun to ship out to people's homes. I'm wondering how many have gone out, and as well, at this point, what is the government supply like? Have the supplies come from the warehouse companies? Have they come from Abbott and iHealth? Are you satisfied with the pace of deliveries to the government?
So thank you for the question. Tests started shipping yesterday. We're hearing stories of some already arriving today. The day after the website launched was midweek, so we started shipping right away. We've made clear to the testing manufacturers that has been contracted with that as quickly as they deliver tests, we will get them out to the American people. The Postal Service is moving incredibly fast here. They are packing and shipping tests immediately as they arrive. Tens of millions of tests have arrived so far. It's an all-hands-on-deck effort. And as we get a clearer picture of the demand of orders through the website and shipments after this initial wave, We'll have a better sense, and we'll report those numbers next week. I want to continue to emphasize that people need a test immediately. We continue to encourage them to utilize one of the many testing options that are out there in addition to the website. 20,000 community-based testing sites nationwide, federal surge sites, dozens of which have opened in the last few weeks, are online and are being set up across the country. Many state and local governments have local distribution of free tests, and tests from online retailers and pharmacies, as we talked about earlier, are now covered by private insurance for free.
Jeff Zients is the White House COVID-19 response team coordinator. The nation's largest abortion protest event could be the last one under Roe. That says thousands rallied here in Washington, D.C. for the annual March for Life anti-abortion event. The Associated Press reporting that ralliers have a growing sense of optimism that their goal is finally within reach. That's as the Supreme Court has indicated it will allow states to impose tighter restrictions on abortion with a ruling in the coming months, and possibly overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that affirmed the constitutional right to an abortion. Participating in the rally, actor and filmmaker Kurt Cameron. He discussed his journey to becoming pro-life.
Some of you, if you're under 20 years old, you might be saying, who's Mike Seaver? But listen, your mom and dad and I have known each other since the 1980s. Yeah, so just think of me as like the long-lost uncle you never knew you had. And some of you wouldn't even be here if it weren't for a movie called Fireproof. Ask your parents, they'll tell you the whole story. Why are we here? The Bible, the book that built America, says that those who hate God love death. But we're the family of faith. We love God, therefore we love life. And our hope is not in the White House. It's not in Congress. Our hope is not in the people who govern us or the laws that we make in this nation. Our hope is in the power of God working in the hearts of his people. And this issue of life is very personal for me. My wife is an adopted child. Chelsea was one doctor appointment away from not existing. Our first four children are also adopted. They were this close to not being here. And if my wife Chelsea had not been born, our two natural-born children would not exist either. So my six children and my wife are here as a result of loving, compassionate, and courageous people like you who are marching today at the March for Life.
Kirk Cameron is best known for his role as Mike Seaver in the 1980s ABC hit sitcom Growing Pains. This event is happening on the eve of the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Here's what White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had to say about the landmark case.
Tomorrow also marks the 49th anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark ruling in Roe v. Wade. Reproductive health care has been under extreme and relentless assault ever since, especially in recent months. It has been nearly 150 days since women in Texas have been denied these constitutional rights. We're deeply committed to making sure everyone has access to care, and we will defend it with every tool we have. That includes continuing to work with Congress to pass the Women's Health Protection Act and codify this fundamental right into law. In the meantime, the administration has taken a range of important actions, from repealing the global gag rule to strengthening Title X family planning program. Today, HHS announced additional Title X grants, and there will be further announcements coming from HHS later as well. This is a moment for us to recommit to strengthening access to critical reproductive health care, defending the constitutional right established by Roe, and protecting the freedom of all people to build their own future.
From the White House, James Brady Briefing Room, Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Meanwhile, most Americans oppose overturning the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade precedent. That's according to a new CNN poll conducted by SSRS, with a majority saying that if the decision was vacated, they'd want to see their own state move toward more permissive abortion laws. In a set of three surveys taken last autumn by different pollsters, Just 30% of Americans say they'd like to see the Supreme Court completely overturn its Roe versus Wade decision, with 69% opposed. Now, according to CNN's polling dating back to 1989, the share of the public in favor of completely overturning Roe has never risen above 36%. And now a reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today.